Welcome to Anaesthesia on Air, a podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name is Duncan McMillan. I am an employee of the college, and I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Ketan Dattaria today. In this episode, we'll be hearing from Ketan on the subject of obesity metabolic syndrome, an area of particular expertise for Ketan and the subject on which he addressed the college's winter symposium last November. Ketan, in November, our past president, Fiona Donald, introduced you as having graduated from the University of London in 1991, training in diabetes and endocrinology, working part-time as a GP, working for a year in intensive care and anaesthetics, then as research fellow in endocrinology at the Mayo Clinic, consultant in diabetes and endocrinology medicine at the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital, and later honorary professor of medicine at UEA. You have over 225 peer-reviewed articles and 20 book chapters to your name, and you chair the Specialist Clinical Examination for Endocrinology and Diabetes and the Association of British Clinical Diabetologists. Ketan, once again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It sounds, it's taken me a long time to get all those titles, but thank you so much.
I'd like to start by saying we were prompted to drag you onto the college podcast in large part because of how well your talks at the college have been received.
Thank you. That's very kind, yeah.
What is it about this subject or your approach to it, do you think, that our members have found so compelling?
I think for me, there are a few things. The first one is that everybody understands that diabetes is becoming more prevalent. It's the most prevalent long-term condition anywhere. And the most recent information that was published in The Lancet earlier on in 2024 showed that there are about 835 million people on the planet with diabetes at the moment. And that's almost 11% of the entire global population. And I think there's an increasing recognition that people with diabetes who have an operation or are admitted into hospital come to more harm. And one of our, you know, raison d'etre as healthcare professionals is do no harm. And therefore, by in trying to improve the care of people in hospital with diabetes, we can partially fulfill that, you know, prime directive for the medical profession. But on the other hand, it's also, as part of that, and I don't mean this pejoratively in any way, it's ignorance. How do you do that? And because the technology, because the medication, the pharmacology, the science has all, you know, really improved and really progressed since most of us were at medical school when we first learned about diabetes when we were junior resident doctors, that actually there's a willingness to learn. Because the recognition that it does impact our day-to-day life, not mine, of course it does every day, but in other specialties, not just anaesthetics and ITU, surgery and everything that we deal with, anybody who has diabetes is going to come to face-to-face with any kind of healthcare professional. And so wanting to learn more, I hope, is part of the reason that people are interested in what I have to say.
What brought you to this area of work originally, and how has it changed over the years, do you think?
So for me, it's interesting because long story, but I fell into diabetes by mistake. But I just happened to work for somebody who got me interested and said, this is the job for you. And I eventually got into diabetes. But what was interesting for me was that when I was a fourth year registrar in medicine, I was very interested in ITU because, as I mentioned, as a medical registrar in a district general hospital, I was looking after the ITU all the time. And I was really, really into intensive care. I made a lot of noise when I was a trainee to say, I want to do intensive care. I want to get more training in that. And I got the opportunity to do, to train, to get an intermediate accreditation in ITU, doing 6 months of anaesthetics and 6 months of ITU. And I thought I decided to do another year of ITU, I would have been an accredited intensivist. But this is back in the late 1990s and early 2000s. But as part of that, because of my training in endocrinology, I thought, well, actually what's really interesting to me is the endocrinology of intensive care and critical illness. And so I tried to get into a lot of, I tried to do some research in that area, didn't get funded. And eventually I ended up going to the Mayo Clinic because I was put in touch with somebody out there who was very interested in skeletal muscle protein turnover. And that was my interest at the time and how insulin affects that. But when I came back to the UK, one of my colleagues in Norwich where I worked was very interested in inpatient diabetes. And at that time, this is 2004, 2005, that was a very fledgling subject. And so I managed to get in at at the ground floor, so to speak, and really got interested in inpatient diabetes, was part of the Joint British Diabetes Societies for Inpatient Care, where we wrote lots of guidelines on the management of various aspects of inpatient diabetes care, where that's where my interest is. Now, many people are not interested in inpatients because the vast majority of diabetes is looked after in outpatients. But the inpatient realm, because more and more and more people, you know, at the moment it's about 11, 12, 13% of inpatients, or maybe more, have got diabetes, and they spend more time in hospital, they cost more money, they come to more harm, and all the other stuff. And I just happen to be one of the people that's interested. So I'm was the leader or the senior author on the global consensus document for the management of diabetic ketoacidosis and HHS. So over the last 20 years, my involvement has progressed, and I've become more and more and more, what's the word I would use? People see me as somebody they can go to for an expert opinion in that in patient diabetes.
In your talk at the Winter Symposium, you focused on obesity metabolic syndrome. Give us a primer. What is it?
So, as many people will have seen, The Lancet has recently launched a commission on obesity. And one of the things that it said, one of the definitions, and I apologize for paraphrasing, is that obesity is a condition associated with increased adiposity that is associated with increased risk of developing physical harm. And metabolic syndrome is slightly separate. So metabolic syndrome is a constellation of conditions which occur together. And so they include obesity, they include hypertension, they include dyslipidemia, they include dysglycemia, so including diabetes, and high uric acid levels, and all kinds of other stuff. There's a debate in the literature about, does it make a difference whether you should diagnose somebody as having metabolic syndrome, or whether because the reason is because if you have obesity, you can treat obesity. If you've got diabetes, you treat diabetes. If you've got hypertension, you treat hypertension. The only real advantage to diagnosing somebody's having metabolic syndrome is to say, well, actually, if you've got one or two of these conditions together, you should be looking for the other conditions because they are all treatable. They're all individually recognized as independent risk factors for the development of premature cardiovascular disease. So you ought to treat all of those individually, but diagnosing one or two, you should be looking for the others as well.
I guess that brings us on to misconceptions. What do you think are the misconceptions that are clinical and cultural about obesity or metabolic syndrome, or the, as you say, the cluster of symptoms associated?
So the by far and away the biggest misconception is that it is the individual's fault. So the reason I say that is because of the stigma that's attached to people living with obesity. You know, we know that there is this thing called the thrifty genotype hypothesis, and many people may not think this is the correct thing, but I think it makes a lot of sense to me. So I'll give you the example. And hopefully most of the listeners will believe in evolution. So if you think about 50,000 years ago, wandering around the plains of Red Lion Street or Red Lion Square, you know, wandering around near where the College of Anaesthetists is, trying to chase your woolly mammoth, okay? And it may be several weeks before you catch and eat your woolly mammoth. And during that time, before you catch it, all you are eating is a bit of grass and a bit of nuts and maybe a bit of fruit if it's that time of the year. But when you catch that woolly mammoth, what you want to do is eat as much as you possibly can and store any excess energy that you don't need there and then. Because you don't know when the next saber-toothed tiger is going to come along, snatch away that carcass and take it away from you. So you want to eat as much as you can. And of course, the thing that the part of that animal that's got the most calories per bite is the fat. You know, we all know that fat has got about 9 calories per gram compared to carbohydrate, which has got 4, protein, which has got 4 calories per gram. And that's why we are evolutionarily designed to find fatty things far more palatable. It's not as though you're going to take a bite out of that raw fat and go, oh, that's disgusting. I'm never having that anymore. That you're going to say, that's yummy. I want to have much more of that. Thank you very much. And that's why your listeners will be aware it's impossible to limit yourself to one Pringle. And the reason is because Pringles are 30% fat. They are designed to be good, feel good on your palate, feel good to your brain to go, that's energy. I need to have more of that. Thank you very much. And therefore, thinking along those lines, you eat as much as you possibly can, you store as much as you possibly can, and of course, in the way that is going to be the most easy way for you to carry it around, which again is therefore stored as fat. Why would evolution allow you to develop a mechanism to lose weight easily? It's not as though you're going to, prehistoric man's going to go, "Oh, I've eaten a bit too much. I'm going to go and run off a few calories because I just can't do it anymore." No, you don't know when your next woolly mammoth is going to come along, how long it's going to be before you catch it, and therefore you need to store it, keep it, and have lots and lots and lots of mechanisms to ensure that when you are energy poor, you have sufficient energy to carry you till your next woolly mammoth. Now, having said that, you've got so many different mechanisms to keep that energy on board. That's one of the things why we're all born fat. Okay, we have the that's the thrifty genotype hypothesis. Now, what happens is that if a child is born into, or if a child is conceived into an environment where the mother has is exposed to nutritional deprivation, something happens to that baby. There are epigenetic changes that make the baby aware that there's going to be not that much food around when it's born. And so what that means, the genes mean that something changes to allow you to conserve energy and use energy very, very, very efficiently indeed. So when the baby is born, of course, that's good. Any energy it's used very efficiently, it uses less energy, so that's brilliant. Now, if the energy availability becomes greater as the child gets older, so the analogy that I use at the moment is many of our parents or grandparents, depending on how old you are, or even great grandparents, depending on how old you really are, were born in the time of just after the Second World War. During the Second World War, during rationing, where there was nutritional deprivation. But as those children grew into adults in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when food availability became greater, the genes, however, are the same. They're still with those thrifty epigenetic changes. But when you've got more food availability, you then start retaining that extra energy. So you then start becoming obese. And then living with obesity is therefore much more common because food availability, evolution hasn't caught up with 24-hour food availability. And this very good data, when I did my research a long time ago, you could see that rats or primates or any animal, even if it was C. elegans, the nematode, if you nutritionally deprive that animal, A, it lives 25 to 30% longer. Okay, then people who are then the animals that are exposed to ad libitum food, for example. But secondly, if that animal then delivers, it has some babies, and you give those babies as much food as they like, they all become obese. And it takes about five generations of ad libitum feeding for the animals to go back to a what we would describe as a healthy weight. So we're looking at another 100 years if there's no period of nutritional deprivation before humanity becomes to a normal weight. Or a healthy weight, I should say. So there are issues that we are all going to be facing for a very long time with all of the diseases of obesity because of what happened in the mid 20th century.
In your talk, you described how the drugs to treat this cluster of diseases have made, Novo Nordisk, the wealthiest company in Europe, and that these drugs will be in our futures for quite some time. Give us a précis of the drugs, their action, and why you think they'll be critical to treatment for some decades still.
So there are these drugs, so GLP-1 analogs and the new one called tirzepatide, which is a GLP, which is glucagon-like peptide 1 and glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, GIP, which is tirzepatide. So I'm going to give your listeners an example, which I hope they'll all be familiar with or at least understand where I'm coming from. So you've been invited to a party by a good friend of yours, and your host and hostess are excellent cooks, and therefore you want to go a bit hungry because you're a bit greedy and you want to just say, you know what, I want to eat a bit more of my friend's free food, and it's very, very tasty indeed. So you go hungry, but you get to your friend's house and the food isn't quite ready then. But what there is a bit of something cold and wet. There's some put something cold and wet in your hand, and there's a few Twiglets and a few Pringles, and you go, you know what, I'm only going to limit myself to one or two crisps if I can, and one or two Twiglets because I want to eat this lovely, lovely food. So you don't have too much to eat, you don't have too much to drink, But by the time the food arrives, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour later, you sit down or you stand up, whatever's going on, and you say to yourself, hold on a second. I was starving when I came through the door. I'm not very hungry now. I've not eaten very much. Why is that? Hopefully, most of your listeners will be familiar with that feeling. You can still override it. You can still fill your face as much as you want, but you'll be aware that you feel less hungry. And the reason is because the carbohydrate in those crisps and those Twiglets and in the drink that you've had stimulates the release of these two hormones, GLP-1 and GIP, from your lower small bowel. And what these drugs do is they are satiety signals. They are released by the lining of your gut. They are taken to your brain and your hypothalamus, to your satiety centers, to say, I've had some food, I don't need any more. And that's why you feel less hungry. But people living with type 2 diabetes, people living with obesity, don't have anywhere near as much of these hormones as people who don't have these two long-term conditions. And so they do not have that satiety signal, so they end up eating more. And if you and because these hormones are the release of these hormones is stimulated by the presence of carbohydrate in the gut, if you have a high fat diet, you don't stimulate them. So, and if you're eating very quickly, so if you're standing having a burger in a fast food joint, you don't stimulate the release of these hormones, and therefore you end up eating that bit more. So when you were very young and your parents told you to put your knife and fork down between mouthfuls, it's because they understood that actually giving time for your GLP-1 to work means that you eat less. Your parents were very clever. Okay, so this is one of the things that we do. So what these hormones are is that they are analogs of these incretin, or they're called incretin hormones. And so they act on the receptors in your brain to make you feel full. They stimulate insulin production by squeezing the beta cells, so you lower blood glucose concentrations. You often inhibit the GLP-1s in particular, inhibit the release of glucagon, which is the hormone that raises blood glucose. GIP does something different and actually releases glucagon secretion. But they work on the pancreas, they work on the liver to improve lipid uptake, reducing inflammation in the liver, and so on. So they do lots and lots of different things, but overall, they limit the amount that you eat, and as a result, you lose weight over time. And with the tirzepatide, which is the newer drug, Mounjaro, it's been shown in people without diabetes to get people to lose 25% or more of their excess body weight, or overall body weight, I should say. GLP-1s are the best. GLP-1 is semaglutide. You can lose 18, 20% of your body weight on these drugs. So they have phenomenal results in weight loss, but they also are very, very impressive for diabetes. And they actually, GLP-1s, so semaglutide has been shown to be very, very good at preventing premature cardiovascular disease, which is something that I, as a diabetes doctor, do. That's my predominant job, is to stop people dying prematurely and to ensure the life that people live is as healthy as it can be. And that's what these drugs do.
You've alluded to potential off-label prescribing of these drugs in future. What's that going to look like?
So at the moment, because these drugs do a huge amount of different stuff. So there's, as I've said, that there's metabolic associated fatty liver disease. So MASLD, as it's now called, used to be called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. But because of the way the drugs work in terms of weight loss, improving lipid metabolism, increasing insulin sensitivity, which is part of the reason why you get fat buildup in the liver, that they're being investigated for the use in fatty liver disease. And the long-term fatty liver disease is a pro-inflammatory condition, and your listeners will be able to remember that long-term inflammation causes fibrosis. Fibrosis of the liver is cirrhosis, and that can eventually lead to fatty and hepatocellular carcinoma. But people living with obesity are at, very high risk of developing MASLD. And so, by people getting people to lose weight, there's a whole series of trials going on in fatty liver disease, which are very, very reassuring and very positive at the moment. But they're currently not licensed for that. You've got the issue about these drugs. I prescribe these drugs in my job as a diabetes doctor. I've got people who've stopped smoking and stopped drinking because it acts on the reward centers. So they're being used in addiction, in smoking, in alcoholism, and so on. So that's another aspect. There's trials going on in Alzheimer's disease and dementia. There's a whole series of phase three trials looking at these drugs in dementia because they work on the blood-brain barrier, and there's a very strong relationship between obesity and diabetes and the development of cognitive impairment and dementia. There's fertility issues. So obesity is related to polycystic ovarian syndrome. So there's a whole group of things that are being investigated, and many more, which I'm not talking about today. that are invested, that these drugs are being investigated for. So watch this space because they are amazing products.
You've alluded to the future for these drugs. Where next for your research, for the work in this field?
So at the moment, the problem is that when you look at the inclusion criteria for the clinical trials for cardiovascular disease, for obesity, for heart failure, and so on, and for renal disease, actually, that if you just limited yourself to the inclusion criteria, the latest data that was published towards the end of 2024 suggests that one half of all adults in the United States would be eligible to be on a GLP-1 analog. So it's an enormous, enormous market. So what I'm doing and others are doing is to say, well, where are the, my interest is in inpatient diabetes. Where is the opportunity to use these drugs? Is there an opportunity to use these drugs in patients as well? But what we've recently published, which is more of interest to the anesthetic and ITU audience, is that I and a multidisciplinary team have just published an anesthesia, which many of you may have seen, on the use of GLP-1 analogs. And then there's another class of drug called SGLT2 inhibitors, and the use in the perioperative time, and why there's a discrepancy between what the Americans have suggested, which is to stop them at least a week beforehand, and why in the UK we've said actually that's not true and you shouldn't stop them, and actually they should be continued all the time. And I'll go through some of the reasons why we've said that. Effectively, it's basically because these drugs have got a very long half-life. They've got a half-life of a week. So if, for example, you were on the top diabetes dose of semaglutide, which is 1 milligram, and you stop it the week before, by 1 week later, you've got the same plasma concentration as somebody who's on 0.5 milligrams who hasn't stopped it. So what's the point of stopping it? It makes no sense whatsoever. The other is, I mean, there are lots of other issues in that there's an enormous amount of data to show that perioperative hyperglycemia is associated with harm. And however you define that harm, it could be surgical site infections, time on hospital, so, time on an ITU, MIs, UTIs, anything you like to describe, all get worse as glucose concentrations go up. And if you stop the drugs, glucose is likely to rise. And then there's this immediate issue of actually, if you've got a high blood glucose on the day you come into hospital, what's going to do? Are you going to mo there's a drive to have day of surgery admission. If you come in with a high glucose and somebody tests your glucose and it's high, what are they going to do? Is there a risk of that procedure being cancelled? And that's no good to anybody. And so by stopping those drugs and increasing the risk of hyperglycemia, increasing the risk of harm, there's no sense to it. Of course, what people at the other side of the Atlantic have said, actually, there's an increased risk of perioperative pulmonary aspiration because it reduces gastric motility. There's a risk of aspiration when you do these procedures. Now, one of the issues is that these drugs have been around for 15 years, and there hasn't been a huge tsunami of complaints to the MHRA or other regulatory authorities saying these drugs are associated with an increased risk of aspiration. Now, that's not, but never happened. The other issues are, of course, that actually most people on these drugs are on the once weekly, and they're on it for a very long time before they go anywhere near a surgeon and an anaesthetist. And what most of the data has been is in the very older agents, which have been once or twice daily, and a lot of the work has been on gastric motility has been done on previously healthy individuals without diabetes, or people who are just on them for a very short amount of time, pre and post being on for a few weeks and seeing what gastric motility is like. And it's not like real life where these people have been on these drugs for a very long time, been settled on them, developed tolerance to the drugs at the reasonably higher doses. So there's no need to stop them. And that's one of the things that we've said in our multidisciplinary publication in Anesthesia very recently.
And as it happens, on this podcast last year, we had Dr. Karim El Bogdadli talking about gastric motility, and certainly you'll forgive my paraphrasing, if he saw it being more relaxed about that maintaining the GLP-1 agonist.
Exactly. He's the first author on the last author on this publication.
You know him well then. Katie, you mentioned SGLT2 inhibitors. That's a future area of interest. Can you give us a summary of what they are and how they work?
So again, this goes back to evolution. So if you think about glucose being an extremely precious molecule, your kidneys, anything that's dissolved in the plasma is filtered into the kidneys. That includes glucose. And your kidneys have this reabsorption mechanism called SGLT2 transporters, which suck back all of the glucose into your circulation so you don't lose any. And if you have hyperglycemia for whatever reason, then those reabsorption mechanism can be overwhelmed, and that means you end up losing glucose in the urine, and you then get the cardinal symptoms of hyperglycemia and diabetes, which is polyuria because you have to pee out extra water when you dissolve the glucose in it. You therefore feel thirsty, so you get polydipsia. If you're peeing glucose into a warm, moist environment full of bugs, you then get thrush. And because you're peeing out calories, you actually lose some weight. So those are the cardinal symptoms of hyperglycemia and diabetes. But what these drugs do is they actually inhibit the reabsorption of glucose. So you actually physically induce a glycosuria. But what that does is that it then mimics the state of starvation. And if you think about what is it that stimulates insulin secretion, it is the presence of carbohydrate or glucose in the blood. And if you lower the glucose in the blood, you then reduce the stimulation for insulin secretion. And insulin does lots of different things at lots of different concentrations. And the very, very first thing that it does at the very lowest concentrations is that it inhibits ketone production. Now, that's important because if you have no carbohydrate in your diet, say we go back to our prehistoric man chasing the woolly mammoth, and you're only eating a few nuts and grasses and so on, you've got very little carbohydrate in your diet. But because you've got very little carbohydrate, you've got no insulin. Therefore, and insulin is the only hormone that allows glucose to enter cells. But if you've got no glucose, you've got no insulin, so there's nothing going to the cells. Your cells are effectively then starving. They need an effective alternative, an alternative energy substrate. And that energy substrate is ketones. So you break down fat to produce ketones, and those are the preferred energy substrate for your heart and your brain. And so when you're starving and you have no insulin, you enter a state of ketosis. And there's very, very good data to show that in healthy individuals, that if you starve them for 4, 5, 6 weeks, then your ketone concentrations can go 5, 6, 7, 8 millimoles per liter. But of course, in people with diabetes, we all worry because the threshold for diabetic ketoacidosis is 3 millimoles per liter. But that's not the issue. It's the rate of appearance of ketones and the ability for the lungs and the kidneys to compensate for the acidosis, that if you're otherwise healthy and you are starved, the rate of ketone production goes up slowly and you can compensate, you become acidotic. In diabetes, when you have no insulin, of course, the rate of appearance is so high, you become quite acidotic. But ketones are very, very good for you if you're not acidotic. There's lots of data to show that if your heart is exposed to ketones, it is that cardiac myocyte mitochondrial efficiency goes up when they're exposed to ketones. So your heart works more efficiently. So if you've got heart failure, ketones are good. And that's why SGLT2 inhibitors are used in heart failure. One of the reasons, apart from the fact you induce a diuresis and it's got for less work to do. If you're using up lipids, using up fat, that's why it's good for fatty liver disease. And so SGLT2 inhibitors have also been shown to reduce premature cardiovascular mortality in people with diabetes and for those living with heart failure, and actually helps preserve renal function. So they're also licensed for people without diabetes who've got renal failure. So that's why there are a lot more people coming to in hospital on SGLT2s because of these benefits. But because they do increase the risk of ketosis and increase the risk of diabetic ketoacidosis, these drugs should not be used in inpatients and certainly not in the perioperative period. The UK says that you can just stop them the day before a planned procedure. The US says use the stop them 3 or 4 days. There's no sense in that now. A paper in Anesthesia says you should not stop them. You should stay with the UK guidance, not stop them too far in advance because of the same issues about hyperglycemia and the development of, or the risk of hyperglycemia and the postoperative harms with that, and the risk of cancelling procedures if they're inappropriately cancelled because they got hyperglycemia. So there's very good reasons for people to stay on their SGLTs for as long as possible, but in the perioperative period, they should be stopped the day before a planned procedure and not restarted until they go home.
Given the current and predicted burden on the healthcare system from obesity-related diseases, if you could wave a wand to mitigate that or just improve health and well-being, what would you do?
I think this is, there's several approaches. The first one is a public health approach, and that is to take away the stigma of people living with obesity. Okay, there is this perception that it's the individual's fault. They eat too much and do too little. That is not the case. It is a long-term condition. You don't penalize people for having high blood pressure. You don't penalize people for having ischemic heart disease. You don't penalize people having osteoarthritis. It's a long-term condition and needs to be treated as a disease and needs to be recognized as a disease. And people need to give the same degree of empathy, sympathy, or consideration to it being a long-term condition. And so just as you don't say, well, you've got high blood pressure, it's your own fault. That you shouldn't say that to people living with obesity. It's not the individual, or type 2 diabetes in particular. It's not their fault. And so that's the first thing. And that's actually probably the biggest hurdle to get over. Once you start looking at an individual living with obesity as somebody with a long-term condition and you deal with them as such, it makes life a lot more considerate. So they get the same degree of political will behind them, not just political, not just with a capital P, but all of the in all of the influence that deal with long-term conditions are dealt with, and people get that same degree of concentration, people with that focus, I should say, as other long-term conditions. So that's the first one. The second one is we all appreciate that there is no money now to spend now to save later. However, treating obesity, we know that there's what 200, 225 conditions associated with obesity, which increase, and then cancer, hypertension, osteoarthritis, diabetes, all the other things I've just mentioned. And therefore, and we know from the UK government, they're saying, well, actually, the number of people who are off work and it's economically inactive, a large proportion of those individuals are living with being overweight and obese. And so, therefore, if you did find some money to spend now, so, for example, tirzepatide to the NHS costs about £90 a month, £90 a week, I'm sorry, £90 per injection. Of course, it's a slightly more. That would, depending on what deal the companies have done with the NHS. But if you spent £100 a month, for example, on an injection, what is given once a week to get people to lose weight, and they lose, okay, let's say they lose a kilo a week, conservative, a kilo a week. After 6 months, they have lost 26 kilos. That's a shed load of weight. Those people can potentially, and they're less addicted, they stop smoking, they're less likely to use blood pressure medication, less likely to use cholesterol medication, less likely to cost the health service money. Within 6 months, they can be economically active, start putting money back into the tax pot, use less resource in terms of all of the money that they need for all of the other conditions that they have. It pays for itself. And so, therefore, if I had a magic wand, I'd say everybody who qualifies for it should get it, and the stigma behind it should be reduced or go away. Those are the two things that I would suggest.
That stigma and the perception links us back to your comments around the evolutionary perspective. What else do you think that evolutionary understanding could usefully inform in clinical practice?
I think that's a really great question. It's actually, I think that there's a lot of work that we that people are doing that we do not yet have answers to. So I think that there's an enormous link between, say, for example, diet and the microbiome and how that influences our health and what the genetic aspects of that. And we know that ultra-processed foods and the diet that we have influences our health, but and there's a very crude, you eat too much, you gain weight, but actually not everybody does that. How does our gut health and our gut, the genetics that we're exposed, or the epigenetics and the genetics we're exposed to influence our health? I think that is probably going to be the most exciting thing. And of course, the pharmacology. I'm a physician, and my job is entirely pharmacological manipulation. But I think it's the pharmacology and the interaction between our gut health, which is going to be the future, that's going to tell us what we ought to be doing and how we ought to do it.
What would you like our listeners to take away from this podcast? What one thing could they do differently or start to do?
So I would say, thank you for listening, first of all. So if you've listened for this long, I say thank you very much indeed. The next thing I would say is, if you see somebody living with obesity, don't be pejorative. Don't even think pejoratively. Don't, it's not their fault. That's the key thing to take away. There are lots of medications which are available to help them. And you know, if people have got diabetes and they've got and they're living with obesity, then actually, if they're not on these medications, you need to ask why. There's another whole class of medication which I haven't really talked about today, and that's SGLT2 inhibitors. And if you have an opportunity to discuss it or to mention it to the surgical colleagues or to the physician colleagues looking after them, saying, is there a reason that they're not on these potentially life-saving drugs that reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease and premature mortality? Why are they not on them? Because they ought to be, and the data is so strong. That's what I would say. I appreciate that, you know, anesthetic colleagues out there, they've got enough to think about, but actually our job is to make people live healthily, people live longer, and we can do that together. And if you think a little bit about pharmacology, say, why are they not on these life-saving drugs? Please, at least think about whether they should be on them.
And for our listeners who want to dig a little deeper, where should they start, do you think?
So, as I mentioned, there's the recently published Commission on Obesity, published by The Lancet, launched in late January or mid-January of this year. Think about the paper that's published in Anesthesia by Karim El-Baghdadi and myself in Anesthesia as well. And there's a paper I published in the British Journal of Anesthesia in April of 2024, again, talking about GLP-1s and SGLT2s and why they ought to be continued in those people on them who are undergoing surgery.
Caton, thank you so much for joining us today on Anesthesia on Air. It's been an absolute delight to have you.
You're very welcome, and thank you so much for inviting me.
If you want more episodes like these, make sure to subscribe or follow Anesthesia on Air and give us a review whilst you're there. Thank you for listening.